You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, November 8th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Dr. Will Strong, Director of Research at the think tank Autonomy, co-author of Overtime, Why We Need a Shorter Working Week, with Kyle Lewis. Also on the program today, Friday night, late night, the bipartisan infrastructure bill passes with 19 Republican votes and the squad voting against it. Polls now have Joe Biden at his lowest approval rating of his presidency. Fifth Circuit temporarily stays the vaccine mandate on big businesses. U.S. eases incoming travel restrictions. And eviction cases begin to surge across the country. Meanwhile, the partisan gap in COVID deaths is growing. Atlanta DA to impanel a Trump grand jury for his involvement in the Georgia election. Eight die, hundreds injured, as crowd surged at the Travis Scott Music Festival. And lastly, Project Veritas, subject of an FBI raid.
Wow, shocking.
All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the beginning of this week. Also, welcome, Emma Viglin,
yes,
to the beginning of this week.
Also known as Monday.
Monday is another way of describing it.
Or lunes.
Or lunes.
That's what I call it.
Yep, we've got a bunch of that stuff going on. Thanks for joining us. Obviously, Friday night, big news, late night, Essentially, Jayapal relented and admits assurances that it's unclear to me even what the assurances were, whether it was that they were going to that the so-called the corporatists in the Democratic House, assurances that they would, I guess, vote for the Build Back Better bill. We still don't know exactly what that is. And Joe Biden's assurances that he's going to be able to get Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema on board. That is, as far as I can tell, what Jayapal was betting on. Five members of the squad?
Six
members of the squad voted against the bill.
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Cori Bush, Jamal Bowman, Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib,
Ayanna Pressley. And their votes were not needed. They probably knew that their votes were not needed. So it's a little bit more of a free vote for them in this instance. However, it's unclear what would happen if Pelosi did not have those 19 Republicans. We'll never know. We should say that there were, by the reporting that we saw from The Intercept and The American Prospect, at least prior to, maybe over the course of the late summer and the early fall, there was up to 30 people who were on the record of committing to not voting for the bipartisan bill without the reconciliation bill being brought up simultaneously.
And then the biggest thing, I mean, I think I mentioned this a few times on this program, the thing that I feared was going to happen happened. Enough Republicans defected to join to vote for the bipartisan infrastructure. And that would have been that was the smartest way if they wanted to tank the Biden agenda. So they have the ability to do that. I mean, it's all really up to Joe Manchin at this point, because the Senate is going to the House is going to send the framework back to the Senate. They're going to work out the details based on the CBO score, which is going to be Manchin's new scapegoat, his new hill to die on when it comes to Build Back Better. And that could destroy the entire thing.
And it is quite possible that and I'm not taking the deficit seriously on these bills at all, but Joe Manchin is using them as a fig leaf, so aren't some of these other corporatists. It's quite likely that the deficit relative to the bipartisan bill will be larger than the Build Back Better bill.
Yes, the reports are what? It's going to add $250 billion to the deficit, and from what we know of Build Back Better, it's not going to be that.
No, but we will see what the final numbers are. Part of this is implicated by what happened in Virginia. Yeah. And so that's a big part of it, both probably for the Republican votes and the Democratic votes. The Republican votes, the moderates, saw that there was an opportunity based upon Virginia. I mean, that's the value of Virginia. It's just simply the narratives that are spun out of it. Whether they are based in any type of reality or not is an open question, but that's the value of it. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking to Daniel Nikanian about some of the school board races that were run across the country and some of the smaller ones to get a real sense of exactly where voters were on this. But here is Josh Gottheimer, just sort of grotesquely corporate, and I don't even know how to really articulate what this guy is. But
well, he carries water for rich people in suburbs of urban areas, including his district, which is in Jersey.
And recall, he's going to be talking about the CBO score. The biggest killer of the CBO score, if you are looking at this from the perspective of what adds to the deficit, will be his insistence on the state and local tax deduction, which 80% of which the benefits go to the wealthiest people in these states. Here's Josh Gottheimer.
Optimistic about moving forward here.
I just want to be clear on what you're saying. Are you saying if the Congressional Budget Office says it is paid for, we wanted to say it's paid for, but what your statement said is that if it is, quote, inconsistent with the White House analysis, meaning it's not paid for, adds to the deficit, that you're going to keep working. So does that mean you would be a no if that's what the CBO says?
What we understand, you know, we received a slew of data this past week from the Treasury Department and from the White House and some early Congressional Budget Office analysis. We were going to receive, we were expecting to receive more in the next 7 to 10 days. We expect it all to match up with what was presented, and we'll move forward.
Okay.
You know, I don't, you know, that is what I believe will happen. And, you know, again, Dan, I think we all agree that the reconciliation package, the Build Back Better legislation, is critically important for our districts like mine. So my expectation will be that we will be moving forward, and we will have another thing to celebrate action, which is, Dan, are really important for the country. They want to see us moving forward for them and fighting for them. That's what I expect will happen.
Let me ask you the flip side of that, and just directly, do you need the Congressional Budget Office to say that the bill is paid for in order to vote yes?
What we're looking for are CBO tables, which score sections of the bill, which we will be receiving. And we already have some data, so there's we expect the information we receive that we received to be in line with what we received from the Treasury Department. And we'll, at that point, I'm sure, be ready to move forward. But we just want to make sure we get that data and that we're able to align it with what we had received already. Listen, I think what's most important for people to understand is the responsible thing to do when you get a piece of legislation like this is to do a full analysis and to understand the impact on your district and the families in your district. And that's what I'm looking at, to make sure that when we vote for this and give the country this win, that we deliver the way we should deliver. And so there's so much in there that matters for my district, you know, from reinstating SALT and lowering taxes, as I said.
Let's talk about that.
To pre-K. So we want to get this done.
Let's talk about reinstating SALT. You know, progressives are.
Yeah. I mean, if he wants things paid for, maybe reinstating SALT isn't the best idea.
Right.
But he doesn't care. Like, he's not going to care about what the CBO score says. The CBO score is going to be for Manchin and Manchin only. Manchin's going to be the one that obsesses over this. As long as SALT is back in the bill, Gottheimer's fine.
I think that's the one
thing that he wants to deliver to the campaign donors that got him to where he is right now in northern New Jersey, and that is SALT. They want the state and local tax deduction back for themselves, and he's going to do that by hook or by crook.
I want a politician who doesn't need a slew of data to make decisions about these sorts of things. And I just thought,
just need the data tables.
No,
need the tables.
CBO tables, right? But that's how our democracy is founded. That's the thread that holds us together.
But like a slew, a place of muck or mire that gets you bogged down.
I mean, well, this has always been, but this is, I mean, he doesn't care about the data. I mean, this has always been the same. This is the next iteration, because it doesn't have the sort of the power that it used to. The next iteration of we can't do this because of the deficit. Nobody takes that seriously anymore. So now it is a question of whether the analysis of Treasury and the administration lines up with the analysis of the CBO, so that we can be sure that we know what we're voting on. That's the theory here, as opposed to simply making a political judgment as to we're going to do this or not. They can't go out there and talk about the deficit so much anymore, because it doesn't quite have the resonance that it used to, and it makes them sound like Republicans too much. So they're going to be making it now about, like, things don't add up. And that's the but we will know, we should theoretically know by Thanksgiving. But I don't know how many times we said that, maybe a million times before. Folks, we've got a couple of sponsors today. First is, not going to lie, last night, overindulged a little bit. Had dinner with my friend and a couple of friends. And
Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi.
Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer. We sat around. Benjamin. And overindulged. As soon as I got home, pack with a liquid IV. That's the way I roll. Of course, I've got this morning too. But
yes.
Last night was a special occasion that I had it not two packets during the course of the show. But of course, as you know, during the show, I'm all about my liquid IV. One stick of liquid IV is 16 ounces of water, hydrates you faster and more efficiently than water alone. Plus, liquid IV tastes great. Flavors like watermelon, strawberry, lemon lime, lemon ginger. Had my orange also this morning. Enjoying a few extra drinks over the holidays. And do what I did last night. Liquid IV contains 5 essential vitamins, more vitamin C than an orange, and as much potassium as a banana. Healthier than sugary sports drinks, there are no artificial flavors or preservatives in Liquid IV, and less sugar than an apple. It's got the optimal ratio of glucose, sodium, and potassium, which delivers water and nutrients into the bloodstream. And on top of that, the company has donated over 4 million servings in response to COVID-19. Products are being donated to hospitals, first responders, food banks, and more. Check it out, Liquid IV, and particularly now if you're traveling more.
Oh, yeah.
It's great to take while you're traveling.
Stay hydrated. You get dehydrated on planes.
All the time. Grab your favorite Liquid IV flavors nationwide at Walmart, or you can get 25% off when you go to liquidiv.com and use the code MajorityRep. MajorityRep at checkout. That's 25% off anything when you order. You get better hydration today using promo code MajorityRep at liquidiv.com. Also, I had my Liquid IV last night and I woke up and brushed my teeth with my Quip. That's the way I roll. Also, now starting to use the Quip mouthwash.
Oh.
Yeah, it's, you know, I like the fresh feeling after that. As you know, or maybe you don't know this, mouthwash hasn't changed in about 140 years. I told that story about taking a plane ride with a guy like 30 years ago who told me, like, yeah, no, it's all booze in mouthwash.
Crazy.
And it's true. And most brands are still selling those big, bulky bottles that are full of basically water and booze. That's why oral care experts at Quip created a mouthwash that gives you more of the ingredients you need. And it also comes in an eco-friendly refill bottle that's 100% recyclable. I'm doing that more and more with a bunch of different products. You know Quip as the makers of the electric toothbrush and floss that I've talked about a million times on and off the show, frankly. Quip mouthwash kills bad breath germs, helps prevent cavities, and leaves you feeling fresh. Thanks to a formula that gives your mouth everything it needs. It's got a 4x concentrate, has fluoride, xylitol, and CPC, but they left out the artificial colors and the alcohol you find in other mouthwashes. And you can get a customizable subscription. You get refills that are automatically delivered to your door every 3 months. Quip's refill bottles are made from 100% recyclable plastic. Mouthwash is the perfect finishing touch for the complete oral care routine. Use your Quip toothbrush, both for kids and adults. Sol's got a small one. Mile and I, we got a bigger ones. The refillable flossers, which are one of the greatest inventions I think I've ever seen in my lifetime. And Quip's great-tasting, good-for-you gum that can help keep your teeth clean between brushings. It comes in like a little Pez-style dispenser.
Love Pez.
Yep. Folks, check it out. It's fantastic. It's a great oral care, oral hygiene regimen. The design of these products is amazing. If you go to getquip.com/majority5 right now, you can get $5 off a mouthwash starter kit. That's $5 off a mouthwash starter kit, which includes a refillable dispenser and a 90-dose supply of Quip's 4x concentrated formula at getquip/majority5. That's spelled GETQUIP, getquip.com/majority5. Quip, it's the good habits company. And lastly, a lot of things stink these days. It's a tough week last week. But you don't have to, and I don't have to.
What are you talking about?
I'm talking about Native DO.
It's a tough week last week?
Yeah.
Were you particularly smelly?
No. No, I'm not saying I smelled last week. I'm just saying, like, the news.
Yeah.
The politics last week.
Got it.
Sweating the news out.
Yeah, I was sweating the news. For a long time, I didn't... I don't know if I stunk. I probably did. You don't necessarily pick up on it, because I wasn't using deodorant, because I didn't want to have all that crap that is in deodorant seep into my body.
This is where Michael would do his Sam voice?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But it was true. And fortunately, to the extent that I stunk, I don't know if I did. Now I don't have to. And I do. And how do I do that? Native. It's all about stopping the stink the right way. It's got products like their legendary aluminum-free deodorant. Also, body wash. Milo is a huge fan of the body wash. They have toothpaste and their brand new mineral-based sunscreen, which it's not that new. I used it over the summer on Sol, and it's very difficult to put sunscreen on his face, and he was okay with this because wasn't greasy. Native's on a mission to overhaul your entire hygiene routine by putting the care in self-care with products carefully made to work against odor that are made from simple ingredients and smell great. You can get their deodorant and body wash in amazing scents like coconut and vanilla, citrus and herbal musk, or my favorite, unscented. They also had a, what do you call it? It's a candy cane peppermint. There was a peppermint body wash, which is actually pretty good, I got to say. I don't generally like the scents.
Nice.
You can also check out their limited edition fall coffee house selection with scents like oat milk latte and matcha and sweet cream. That actually sounds pretty interesting to me. Now I'm hungry. You can even build your own personalized bundle of products. Mix and match three of your favorite scents. look, the bottom line is there's a lot of garbage in a lot of these deodorants, and I don't like to put it on my body. And of course, you know, different people react differently to things like deodorant. But for me, it has been, I think, probably a game changer. I mean, I don't know the score, but I suspect that it has been. And for me, I don't like, the unscented, but the body wash, Candy Cane body wash, pretty good, peppermint. Look, stay fresh, stay clean with Native by going to nativedo.com/majority report. Use promo code Majority Report at checkout. You get 20% off your first order. That's nativedo.com/majority report, or use the promo code Majority Report at checkout for 20% off your first order. All right, want to welcome to the program Dr. Will Strong. He is the director of research at the think tank Autonomy and co-author of Overtime, Why We Need a Shorter Working Week, which he wrote with Kyle Lewis. Well, welcome to the program. I'm here with Emma Vigeland. Can you hear us?
Oh, you're on mute, Will.
How about now?
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can. Here with Emma Vigeland. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, guys. I'm happy to be here.
I am very much on board with the 4-day work week, as I have been for a while on this program.
In fact, you're so on board with it that you do it.
That's how on board I've been.
Yeah.
and it is, and I want to get to like what I do on those days, which is, I think, very similar to what you anticipate people would do on those days and have found that people do on those days. But let's just start with the concept of our 40-hour work week. This is not the 40-hour work week does not exist in nature. Will you talk about how we came to a 5-day work week that is 8 hours long?
Yeah, no, it's a fascinating story and a really rich history, and that's one of the joys of writing the book with Kyle, has been kind of interrogating that history and ultimately it teaches us many lessons about how changeable our working time is. So, I mean, I won't go through it all, but I think if you look at, for example, American history, US history, you can go back deep into the 19th century, looking at debates around slavery and how these dovetailed with working time debates at the time. Some of the first strikes in US history were around working time, about regulating the working day. Of course, you know, we've gone from 70, 60 hour weeks right through. So the early part of the 20th century, you see kind of labor trade unions really taking up this fight and kind of taking it to politicians, basically. And ultimately, when it gets to the New Deal, just in the 1930s there, you have Frances Perkins, who works in Roosevelt's office, and she's deeply connected to the trade union movement, and she puts working time right on the agenda, and you get I think it's the Fair Labor Standards Act, where basically working time is limited to, I think, 44 hours to begin with, and down to 40. So these kind of movements, moving from, you know, huge drops in working hours from 60 to 44 and then ultimately 40, in just a few decades, shows that the malleability of our working time. And the same happened here in the UK, that it was roughly after World War II that you have trade unions around construction and mining demanding restrictions on working hours for cases such as freedom and other arguments deployed. And so what we take for as granted, you know, the 2-day weekend, the 5-day week and so on, there's nothing natural about that. That was an achievement, and it's an achievement quite a long time ago. And so that's why we're arguing for kind of a new progression in that working time reduction, which for us is a sign of progress.
I learned from your book that it was in the mid 1800s in Australia, where I guess the first sort of organized a demand for a shortened work week existed. What is your sense of the relationship between it being adopted in one country and another? I mean, and do you think, as a subsidiary question to that the labor union has stronger or weaker international ties? I mean, I just want to get this, you know, I want to go through obviously the value of and the implications of shortening the work week, but I want to get a sense of just like how in the past this has we've seen these changes spread internationally, and whether that is something that we can anticipate happening, you know, in the future.
That's a really good question. I mean, I think in the past, I think by the very nature of, let's say, communications technology and the nature of the speed of where this information can travel, I think it was often quite nationally based. So as you mentioned, the stonemasons in Australia had their own Labor Day created simply because of the actions of these stonemasons arguing for the 8-hour day. The US had its own particular context, civil war and so on, where some of these arguments were progressing. And here in the UK, similarly, World War One was a big catalyst here in the UK. I think as things stand now, in terms of the current situation, international precedents and examples are incredibly important. When we started doing research for the book and also for the think tank in which we run, there were very few contemporary examples of work and time reduction really kind of taking place. I'm sure they existed, but ultimately there wasn't much of a kind of an awareness, and there wasn't much coverage of this issue. And over the last 5 years, you know, I think everyone now has heard of, for example, the Iceland trial that's just been happening over the last 5 years. We've all heard of experiments in Sweden. Now Spain has taken it to their national government. It's really accelerating the pace of this discussion internationally. And trade unions, for example, here in the UK, who we work with, often it's not just an idea coming from someone on the shop floor, on the branch, even though working time has always been part of trade union agendas. Often it's someone seeing something happening elsewhere and saying, hang on a second, working time is being reduced in that area. What about the 4-day week? I've heard about it in the media and so on. So it's a really interesting set of feedback loops internationally as well as through the national press as well. So, I mean, I from my perspective and my current work, it's huge having this international relationship.
I'm going to refute your assertion that people know about Iceland, frankly, because I don't think we don't hear about that nearly at all, I think, in this country. And I'm going to ask you to talk about that experiment in a moment. But give us a sense of like what we're talking about here. Why 4 days as opposed to 3 days? Why 4 days as opposed to 4.5 days? I mean, what is it? Is there something specific about 32 hours, or is it simply what has been tried and in the same way that there was nothing necessarily specific about 40 hours?
Yeah, I think there's a combination here of strategic purposes as well as feasibility in the shorter term. So I think, for example, at Autonomy, the think tank, which I'm the director of research, we talk about the shorter working week because we think working time reduction is the broader frame which we should be talking for campaign usage, like in the 4-day week campaign in the UK or the 4-day week campaign in Spain and in the US, it's growing as well. The 4-day week is a good slogan. We all know about the 5-day week. What does a 4-day week mean? It does what it says on the tin, basically thinking about adding an extra day to the weekend and so on. So there's a strategic use for it. Shorter working week doesn't roll off the tongue. At the same time, and when we talk to firms who are making that shift, you know, if you're used to running a business at 5 days or at 40 hours, taking a jump down to 3 days a week, which might sound desirable, is quite a big leap. So there's also a kind of a feasibility, element to this where, we know, for example, there's lots of elasticity in the way the your working day works, and many occupations can move to shorter working weeks, but it will have to be gradual, as it was in the past as well. So it's a mixture of a kind of strategic campaign demand, which is very simple and bold, but also one which many firms can carry out immediately, irrespective of like a campaign pushing it towards. And I think we shouldn't forget that you know, let's say capital isn't one big homogenous blob. We should really encourage firms who are moving into that in that direction to do so. So 4-day week is feasible.
Well, what's the problem that this is going to solve? I mean, aside from like, you know, I know for me personally, like I get a lot of administrative stuff done, both life administrative stuff, but also in terms of, frankly, of the show. But so I mean, I'm technically, you know, not working at all, but that day I have a lot more flexibility in terms of where I dedicate those resources. But what is the broader argument in terms of A, what it would do for quality of life, but B, also what it would do for empowerment of labor. And we should say the idea here is no loss of pay.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. So, I mean, I'll try and be as brief as possible, but it's what Rucker Bregman calls a multi-dividend policy, really. I mean, I think from our perspective, this first and foremost has to be about improving working people's lives, well-being, and so on, and a better deal at work. So I guess the broader frame here is we've had decades of the withering away of working conditions, the kind of slow increase of work of overtime in the UK, for example. I'm sure it's the same in the US. Overtime is a huge issue. And so on the one hand, it's about kind of giving a bold new demand to instead of just high wages and restrictions on overtime. In fact, actually, we're going to take one step further and be bold and say, wait a second. It's been 80 years since we had legislation for the 5-day week. We've had an increasingly productive economy. Where has that been distributed to? Well, it hasn't been coming down to the workers broadly in the last 30 years. So what kind of demands can we make, as well as high wages and so on, greater taxes and whatever, to basically improve working life? And we think a really non-reformist demand would be for, or a non-reformist reform, as it were, would be working time reduction. The weekend, it's been very hard for people to erode the weekend, for politicians and so on to erode the weekend. It's happening, but nonetheless, if you create a 3-day weekend as a new cultural standard, I think that would be really significant. So on the one hand, that's why it's an important strategic demand, and one which will be just hugely transformative for the way that our economies work at the shop floor level. And a couple of other things I'll just rattle off. I mean, the research on the environmental impacts is pretty robust. We've done our part to try and help that case.
I'm sorry, I want to get into that, but I want to stay for a moment on this, on what we're talking about in terms of productivity, because we know in this country, just in terms of relative to the minimum wage, let's say, that if there has been such an increase in productivity by workers over the course of the past 60 years, let's say, that if the minimum wage was to have kept pace with productivity, it would be $18-19 more than it is now, going from like 7.25 to like mid-20s in terms of an hourly wage. So this money has gone somewhere, and it has not gone to workers. And so, and as the productivity increases, right, that creates a certain amount of, theoretically, of slack in the labor market, which then diminishes the power of labor to drive up wages. And so this, by shortening the work week, we're empowering workers both on a wage basis, in addition to all the other benefits that we'll talk about in a minute. But I want to talk about this dynamic of wealth inequality, which has grown exponentially, and how this will impact that.
Yeah, well, precisely. I mean, you've pretty much said it. I think by increasing the per hour wage, by reducing time, you effectively are, you're increasing workers' per hour pay. You allow for a tightening of the labor market in favor of workers, effectively increasing a certain scarcity of labor. And therefore forcing employers who have the cash, they have the income to increase employment, for example. I think there's a role to be played by the state, of course, in terms of employment. Public sector employment is huge as well. But yes, effectively, working time reduction is a tool for increasing basically worker voice, allowing a greater control over how much a surplus that employers can draw on, basically. And that's why it's so important. And traditionally, that's why it has been demanded, but particularly tied with productivity gains. This is, new machinery in the workplace. How is that going to speed up our life, going to make our work more intense and so on. And the demand was basically that time should be distributed amongst ourselves. I mean, I think some of the stories which we didn't actually include in the book, for example, early organized labor actions in the US, for example, when it was only the boss who had a timepiece, and a watch or a clock or whatever. And basically, they would add half an hour on. They'd kind of lie to their workers and say, okay, actually, it's still half an hour left and so on. And so in this one particular town, I forget which one, it's in a book I can recommend, the workers built a giant clock in the middle of the town to say, that's the time. Like, you can't fool us with your fake or kind of dodgy clock. That's the time by which we work. And so I think, yeah, I mean, it's by controlling that time, by having limits on when we work, it's always been about collective worker power as well as individual choice.
How do you, there's just so many different tiers to how workers get time off in specifically in America. Right now we're seeing the Kellogg strikers, many of whom said that they were working over 100 days in a row. So like the weekend even of itself is a aspiration for a lot of workers in America. A lot of workers just don't have a weekend. So I'm just curious how you approach that particular part of the workforce where a two-day weekend is already pretty far out of reach in the late-stage capitalist way that we're operating here in the United States, for example. And then also, of course, in countries that we exploit in global capitalism on a daily basis.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think it's obviously tragic that people can work, somehow can work 100 days in a row. In the UK, there's a great study by the TUC here on 12% of workers surveyed said they worked 7 days, for example. I think working time I don't want to reduce the issue of working time simply to a 4-day week demand or to a certain set of workers. I think working time is an issue for literally all workers within a capitalist economy when time is money and productive time is incredibly valuable. So there was always a disposition, there's always a pressure on workers to keep working, give us your overtime and so on. So absolutely. I think regulation is basically the way and the demands from the workforce itself. I also don't want to make the 40 week to be a silver bullet, basically. I mean, I don't think you could any demand or any policy is going to sort out labor markets. I do think it can speak to a number of issues, including holiday, maternity leave, sick pay, and so on. Like time away from work is if you look at the list of demands of trade unions throughout history, about 15 or 20 of them are basically to do with working time in some way, holiday, maternity leave, and so on. So I think it's only a good thing that this discussion of radically transforming the way that we work and how long we work for, I think that actually can lift a number of other demands with it. I would say, in contrast to just more holiday, I would say that regular time off is slightly qualitatively different. I think even just on the issue of burnout, I think we all recognize that 2 weeks holiday is great, for example, really like transformative. But then once you're back at work, it's the grind again. Regular time off, as has been shown in some studies, is actually really significant. So I think there is something different about other ways of taking time off and the shorter working week. But I take your point that basically some kinds of workers aren't even at the level where they can restrict their working week to 5 days. They are just worked off their feet.
I would also refute the idea of a 2-week vacation. What is that?
It's much worse in the US than it is.
Yeah. Well, a 2-week vacation.
I know.
Well, let's talk. Let's start with that, the experiment in Iceland, because I don't think there is wide awareness of that experiment. What was the nature of the experiment and what has it shown?
Yeah. So, sorry for being presumptuous. Basically, there was a 5-year trial across 200 different public sector organizations, about 2,000 employees, in Iceland. And that's about 1% of the entire workforce. It's a small country, and there were all sorts of different services involved: childcare services, even police stations, but generally administrative work, public administration. And across 5 years, different workplaces reduced their working week without losing any pay by a certain amount of time. So some organizations, it was only an hour, some it was 4 hours. And that doesn't seem much, but it reduced their working week to often around about 35 hours. And that was across a 5-year period. And basically this was tracked and evaluated quite a granular level. And so we managed to publish the results of that. It was kind of done in conjunction with trade unions. And obviously the results might be as you'd expect. Basically all the workers, even those only taking an hour, 2 hours off a week, thought it was great. Generally organizational performance was basically as good, if not better than before. More time spent with their families, taking up hobbies and so on. All the things which we'd probably do, which sound a bit cheesy, but I think it's quite heartwarming. And effectively what's happened after that, this is the best thing, I think, what's happened after the trial evaluated and so on, was that trade unions then organized new contracts for not just the public sector employees who took on the trial, but also wider private sector as well. So now 86% of the country's workforce now has new contracts, either with directly with shorter working hours or with new mechanisms by which they can negotiate shorter working hours in the future. So it's a really significant and great example of there being a trial and then trade unions building on that and establishing a new norm across the country. And that's about 170,000 people of a 200 and something thousand workforce. So it's a small absolute number, but quite a high relative number. I mean, imagine if 86% of the US workforce had new shorter working hours contracts.
And we should say, theoretically, when you're talking about smaller enterprises, right, the margin of error is less. You're talking about a smaller country. The margin of error, theoretically, would be less in terms of what it does for the productivity of that country. I mean, I would imagine in this country we have a lot more redundancy than you would in there's a lot less redundancy in this enterprise than there is in a TV show on a cable news place. So I would imagine if there was to be a drop off in productivity, that you would see that. Now, with that said, and maybe this is sort of getting ahead of ourselves a little bit, but like, is there value in pitching it in that way? I mean, is this about? Is there value in, or what is the value, I guess I should say, in pitching to the capitalists that, like, hey, this is going to, you could see an uptick in productivity. You will have less training of workers because there'll be less burnout. I mean, as opposed to making it a demand in terms of worker power.
Yeah, so I think it's a good question. You're always speaking to slightly different audiences. It's what I found in my experience so far is that it's incredibly useful to have precedents established across different aspects of the economy. So different companies moving toward, I don't think we should sniff at new companies providing shorter working weeks, decent working conditions for workers in general. And these precedents are incredibly useful because to some extent, this idea needs to, in its kind of, let's say the sharp, jagged edges of the future coming through, there needs to be instantiations of this idea. And as much as we don't want to necessarily use simply like decent business standards as examples, it's so up until now we've just been using this one Swedish care home, for example, with the Gothenburg example where they reduced the working week and so on. Now we have a whole plethora of forms of industry using shorter working hours for that, for the purposes you just mentioned, whether it's productivity increases, staff well-being and so on. My favorite frame is not necessarily to say this is a business strategy, although I think it is. I think the most important thing is that as this idea gets bigger, as it becomes more and more mainstream, and the examples like the Ireland trial and so Iceland's trial and so on are important, I think it's important that I get steered in the direction of this is about giving more time to workers without a loss in pay. It's empowering and basically will benefit the vast majority of the population, and businesses can adapt. It's not an impossible idea. And I think the idea of getting rid of the impossibility of it is incredibly important as we move to actually making it a reality. And so for me, as the trade union movement wakes up to this, they have a whole range of arguments and angles to take to each of their employers they're dealing with. And it's not just one which says, we just want this. There's a whole range of things you can talk about. And I think that's basically really powerful. I don't think it's a negative thing, even though it perhaps shouldn't be front and center.
Tell us about the benefits from an environmental standpoint that have been found. Again, I guess, these are second order on some level, but one would not necessarily anticipate that there would be environmental benefits.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because I used to consider them second order, absolutely. And I think in this particular moment, as COP's going on, it becomes slightly less second order to discuss the environmental benefits of a policy. So, I mean, we've always considered it to be, we've always been interested in the available research, particularly, for example, Juliette Shaw, based in the US. She's been the Overworked American. That's a great book. She's been talking about the environmental benefits of shorter working hours for decades. So we've always paid attention to that, but I think there's been some great work done since. Looking at, for example, 27 OECD countries, looking at the correlations between working time and carbon emissions. There's been a strong correlation, particularly even household consumption of carbon intensive goods. The longer, in fact, longer working hours is a stronger indicator than higher wages for the consumption of carbon intensive goods. It's not really about how much you earn, it's about how long you work. This is not really just about the kind of work we do, like whatever, having electricity on and so on, but it's really also around the consumption that goes with it. So things like commuting, a lot of people still drive to work by car and so on. And even some studies we've done on electricity use, normally weekday evening in the UK, for example, is peak electricity use. On the weekends and on bank holidays, much greater reduction in electricity use kind of makes sense. You might be outside the house and so on. So what we're looking at here is basically a double win. Let's say greater well-being, time away from work, but also one which can help reduce our carbon footprints in a range of ways. And I think ultimately, what we try to make the case in the book for is that the current debates around the climate, Green New Deal, degrowth, post-growth, and so on. Not always is there a kind of a question about how we transform the way we work. Often we either assume an industrial model just scaled down, or we don't really talk about it. But I think working time reduction, a key demand of workers' movements for centuries, really has to be there. It gives a kind of what we call a key ingredient for green movements, a bit of hope about the way that our work will be changed. A bit of, Kate Soper talks about hedonism, kind of green hedonism. How can we, feel like it's not just going to be austerity, but sustainable? We want to make sure that people feel that actually, it's going to be great because we're going to have shorter working weeks and we're going to be able to have a livable planet. That's what we think.
And much of that saving that you're talking about in terms of carbon reduction would be from those sectors of business that are more production oriented as opposed to service, right? Because I have a hotel, I have a 4-day work week. I'm still going to have people come in on that fifth day. It's just going to be different people, right? I mean, that's basically it.
That's true. But I guess precisely. So for example, if you shut up shop and you're a manufacturing or construction company, if you shut up shop on the fifth day, that's going to be a big saving compared to a hotel, which cannot do that. Absolutely. But I think it's as Juliet Shaw's studies have shown, it's also about it's about the consumption that comes around the workplace, the kind of work as well. I mean, let's be realistic. We're going to try and green these industries, some industries are going to have to be scaled down and so on. But in terms of, for example, commuting, carbon intensive goods, we all know what it's like to get home from work and you order a delivery or you are using bottled water. All these kinds of goods are very, very highly correlated to a very work-centered lifestyle. And so it's a bit of both. It's not just about scaling down certain industries. It's also around kind of the whole carbon economy of how we live when we work a lot.
You also make the argument that it is a shorter work week is about some measure of gender equality as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we can boil that down into kind of two arguments, really. One is, and we emphasize this a great deal, by delving into some kind of to a lot of feminist debates from the 1970s onwards, 60s onwards, really is really about the sheer amount of time that women work versus men, and that's including the unpaid labor of the home. So things like childcare responsibilities, food preparation, cleaning, and so on, still falls on women to do that kind of work, even though we've seen a much greater participation in the formal labor market. So you have what's called the second shift, and so the first argument is to say, well, actually, if we talk about the kind of net amount that men and women work a lot more, and so working time reduction, even in the formal economy, is of great interest to them, mainly because you also have the knock-on effect of allowing for a greater sharing of those responsibilities if both men and women are working less in the formal labor market. That's one argument which I think is important to make, although we must admit that the culture change around the division of labor is not just going to be solved by giving people more time, but it'll be greatly enhanced. The second is that, particularly in the UK and other global north countries, although actually you could say this about the global labor market in general, women tend to be in jobs which are more stressful. So things like public sector work, teaching, nursing, care roles tend to be have greater participation by females, and that kind of work is often low paid and has a huge amount of burnout and stress. So it's also in the interest of female workers to have working time reduction in general, precisely because they're in some of the most stressful roles in the formal labor market. So we briefly glossed that case. We talk about some of the theoretical history of this demand, and it's great to see women's groups, particularly during COVID and the kind of homeschooling debates, really take up the demand for short working weeks as a demand, really.
Let's just talk briefly about, I mean, it seems to me there's two major obstacles to doing this. One is sort of the political will, and I guess the desire for the capitalist class to not empower workers because it's going to cost them at one point or another. But before we get to that, let's just talk about some of the practical things. Like, how do you deal with the idea? I mean, obviously, it would have to be mandated on some fashion, the way that our current work week is, right? How do you prevent some firms from bringing in a second shift, or does that matter at that point? In terms of you know, one firm trying to be more competitive than another. So I own a widget shop and I do 4 day a week and I'm able to squeeze in, you know, production out of those four days. Is there a scenario where other firms will, try and get out ahead, or is it just going to be statutorily, I guess, prevented from doing so?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's you pick up on a really important point. It's about how is this either deployed, how is it enforced, who are the actors involved, where's the pressure coming from? We do make the point throughout the book that this needs to be taken up by the labour movement, and we're happy to see that it is. In, for example, the CWU here in the UK, Forza in Ireland, other trade unions, for example, IG Metall in Germany. So it's absolutely, we think basically without pressure from at the shop floor level and around a collective bargaining unit like a trade union, the shorter working week won't be able to, or the 4 day week won't be able to be sedimented in a way and enforced in the way that it basically needs to, as in the past when trade unions have won the shorter working week. So it's not A, simply relying on the goodwill of businesses. It's not, it can't simply be kind of an expectation given by policymakers, given by government, and allowing the private sector to kind of do it or not do it. It has to have that pressure, and that's why, you know, I think while it's important to look at the precedents and the currently existing first movers of employers who are doing it off their own back, I don't think we'll get there by one employer at a time. Basically, I think it's going to have to be off the back of that kind of struggle, as it has been in the past. So I think when it comes to, you know, there will be those issues for those first movers if they're doing shorter working weeks, the competitors aren't. Even though there will be productivity gains, even though there will be certain advantages for recruitment and retention and so on, those issues will potentially be there. We haven't seen them yet in the kind of the first mover companies that we're working with. But I think ultimately that's not really the strategy. I think the strategy is widespread pressure from social campaigns and trade unions and politicians recognizing this is what the kind of labor market that should be the case for all of the reasons we've mentioned, environmental and also kind of greater democracy and so on. That's how it's going to be implemented at a scale. I don't think it should be up to individual competitive capital units.
Is there a fear that, like, I mean, one of the things that occurs to me is that, you know, particularly in, various cities around this country, it's not inconceivable to me to see something like where you have a 4 day work week and then all of a sudden everybody jumps into like these gig economy things on the fifth day. What is there a way to inhibit that, or is there a concern about what that will do in terms of just like making that gig economy just, I mean, as exploitative as it is now
with the 5 day work week,
right?
Yeah.
But with I wonder, a 4 day work week, is this going to sort of drive down? It's going to be a race to the bottom on that fifth day for people, or maybe it won't be. I mean, I don't know.
I mean, I think Emma makes an important point that there are already a lot of people doing second jobs because they can't afford to just do the normal 9 to 5. And a shorter working week with the same pay won't necessarily change that. They'll just have more time, which is actually probably a good thing in general. I don't think it will make the gig economy worse. I think there's an every possibility that, yes, on the fifth day, you might, you know, carry out an extra work because you want some more money and you didn't mind working the fifth day. What's important is that you have that option now. And so a lot of the workforce still will actually take that day off. Time is free time is an important resource. People really value it. And that would be significant if you can have a huge chunk of the labor market in effectively releasing the benefits of a 3-day weekend. For the gig economy, that needs, you know, much greater regulation, trade union power, enforcement, and so on. That's the case. And I think we should all get behind, you know, in many cases, you know, companies like Uber and so on don't make any money. They're just bad companies. They're just backed by a lot of venture capital. They don't make a profit. Maybe, you know, we shouldn't be allowing for these companies, which are basically failed companies, allow them to dominate certain markets. For example, that's a slightly different conversation to the shorter working week, which I think we shouldn't, just because some workers can't afford to have a normal job without having an extra job. I think that's a tragedy, but nothing, something which a shorter working week will make better, if anything, by giving people more time.
All right. So lastly, like, what, in terms of like the political strategy in this country, where I don't hear unions pushing that as much as they may be doing in Europe, like, what?
It almost just seems so out of reach here that I, like, in terms of realistic gains for them, it's a little harder, I would imagine, in the United States.
Yeah. At one point in our old office, we had, I think it was someone from, I can't remember if he was Danish or Swedish, came to visit the show. I think he was a journalist. And, We were talking about the idea of the working poor in this country. And he said, we don't.
What's that?
What is that? We don't have that. And it was like talking to someone from the future or something. And on some level, like, and I think maybe, you know, because we don't have the physical proximity to Iceland and certainly the inclination by our media, you know, to promote those type of ideas, that it does seem sort of that much more far away. But from your vantage point, do you see any green shoots, as it were, in terms of this, you know, this push in this country?
For sure. There's already brewing. I think it's going to build much faster. The US's own 4-day week campaign, which I think they're doing a lot of the groundwork for now. I won't say much about it. I'm not directly involved, but I know it's a much more kind of fully orchestrated social campaign is coming on its own. I hope it dovetails and links up with the trade union movement. That's TBC, but I'm fairly hopeful. I think there's a general discussion globally. I think the US, you know, is seeing these widespread strikes. There's a global discussion, a kind of like almost a ripple effect from 2008, but particularly accelerated by COVID around not going back to the old normal, basically, and changing how we do things because things weren't working before, and COVID laid that bare, basically. And I think part of the discussion of what the new world of work should be, of how we value people, how we value certain kinds of work, should and is starting to include questions of working conditions, and within that, what good work means. And I think what good work means, it should always be emphasized, is enough time for yourself, enough time for a good life. Now, that seems almost impossible in the US's and indeed a lot of the UK's economy, simply because of the withering of all these things we've been talking about. Nonetheless, you know, globally, particularly US and UK, labor shortages are being turned into certain wins for workers. £15 wage is now being won by lorry drivers in the UK, for example. And we've just done some polling on what would workers in key industries where a lot of them are leaving, what would keep them in long term. And they say good work-life balance, high wages and decent working conditions. I think once, and I would encourage, I'm not sure, I hope some trade unionists are listening in the US, if once you get this on the table and you show that actually it's something that can be fought for and won, and there's plenty of research and precedents now, please look out there. And I think it's something which really can get taken up. And so I have full hope that in this period of change and acceleration of change, the debate around working time, which won't go away, no matter how many, how often this debate is kind of seen as untenable, the question of how long we work for and the stress at work and so on is going to be around for forever. And so I think, yes, I'm entirely hopeful about that.
Dr. Will Strong, Director of Research at the think tank Autonomy, co-author of Overtime, Why We Need a Shorter Working Week, with your co-author, Kyle Lewis. Thank you so much for your time today. We will put a link to that at majority.fm.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, guys. Cheers.
All right. Gonna head into the fun half.
Whoa.
Yep.
Just like that.
Just like that. 646-257-3920 is the...
Still getting used to this.
What's that?
Just the freewheeling structure.
Yeah.
Hey.
Whatever. Just going to jump right into
it. Interview. Bye.
Bye. Folks, it's your support. Oh, a reminder.
Live show.
We have a live show. And if you go to majoritylive.com, you can buy tickets. Oh, what? I forgot what was that URL Sam said? Was it Majority Report Live? Yeah, it's that one too.
I was hanging with my cousin and her friend this weekend, and I told her some of the people I know are going to be there. People don't know yet. And she goes, oh, can I come?
Mm-hmm.
So, Katie wants to come.
Mm-hmm.
Shout out to Katie.
Get your tickets now, folks. They're not going to last forever, I promise you. I promise you. MajorityLive.com. January 16th. Sunny Boston. We'll be there 3 p.m. Give you time to travel in and travel out if you want. I think that we confirmed that that's Martin Luther King.
It is.
Okay, so you also maybe, hopefully, you have Monday off. What better city than to celebrate Martin Luther King than Boston? Jeez.
And after that, we'll go on the Freedom Trail, right?
Yeah, well. Yeah.
That's the
actually the Freedom Trail is very close to Wilson.
I actually am going to do that. I'm excited to do that because that's in. I know about that from the video game Fallout.
Matt, you're
is
like,
this the first time you've ever been to Boston?
I've never been to Boston. Been to
seriously,
Salem. Been to Salem, but not Boston.
And Matt has bought all sorts of Cheers paraphernalia because he wants to go to the Cheers pub.
Matt, you are the Freedom Trail's nightmare customer.
Yeah, I'm gonna ask some questions.
You're gonna like they're gonna be
dude,
acting.
Could you just keep it down, please? We're trying to do something here, and you keep asking all these questions.
That's
all
how
right?
You get the John Adams guy to break characters.
Exactly.
When you like talk about global capitalism.
How did Adams feel about democracy? Popular democracy.
All right, yeah, whatever. Did you go to Cheers? Did you go to Quincy Market? All right. Go to Quincy Market. All right. Ask somebody at the information booth.
That's going to be a part of the Majority Report immersive experience. We're just going to take the whole Will Bethesda, I can't do the accent, out on the Freedom Trail, and then Matt can do a real history of the United States.
We're all going to go on a big one of those duck boats. The amphibious duck boats. They arrive right into the What's the name of the
Walden Pond.
River?
Is it
the,
I mean, I can't you're even
remember
to
what,
know this.
I can't remember what the...
Can you take an amphibious vehicle into Walden Pond?
You cannot, no.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
You can go swimming,
that's
but
lame.
That's about it.
Swimming in a pond?
Yeah.
All right.
Of course.
It depends on the size of the pond.
Under a jet ski.
Yeah.
What accent was that?
That was my voice.
Oh, all right. Folks, again, Majority Live. Check it out. Also, you can become a member of this show. Go to jointhemajorityreport.com. Support this show. Get extra content. And the AM Quickie. Blowing up the Charles River. Oh, my God. I can't believe I forgot about it. That's where the regatta was. The head of the Charles. You see the regatta with the guys driving those thin boats with the rowers.
I wonder which Charles that's named after, if that's the one that got his head cut off or the second one.
It doesn't matter. It don't matter. Probably both.
Probably.
Go check out the regatta. I think that probably just happened, actually. AMQuickie.com. Sign up for our newsletter. Check it out. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekian media universe?
Yeah, busy weekend in the Matt Lek media universe. First of all,
Lekian.
What did I say?
Lek.
Oh, yeah, Matt Lecky and Media Universe. We had Think Tank, me and Griscom. We talked about, among other things, a lot of the Discord questions, but Raja Bell commenting on the Phoenix Suns owner case and how it's kind of just, that's what ownership means, is abusing the people that work underneath you. And also, can I get a fanfare, actually, Sam?
Oh, this is exciting. I didn't know about any of this.
Episode 40 of Literary Hangover is now live. 2 hours and 43 minutes on The Adventures of Colonel Daniel Boone by John Filson. The original, the seminal text in the myth of Daniel Boone, where it says how he conquered the natives in Kentucky and lived to bear the fruits of his labor there. But we actually go into the reality, which is he left Kentucky indebted and hating the place and vowing to never come back because it was taken over by lawyers. So it's kind of myth versus reality on Daniel Boone. I'm really excited about this episode. If you haven't heard Literary Hangover, this is a good one to jump in at.
I am psyched because I was a kid. I used to watch that show all the time.
Yeah. Apparently, well, one thing about that.
My understanding is that Daniel Boone was a man.
He was.
A big man.
No, that's Paul. I think you're thinking about Paul Bunyan.
No. Daniel, I'm pretty sure the song goes Daniel, let's Google this.
Are you trying to like,
oh, the
you're
theme
saying
song?
His size,
the theme
song. His physical size?
I'm just singing that. I was actually starting to actually just say the theme song.
Oh, why don't you sing?
Oh,
nah.
Yeah,
pass on that one.
Yeah, well, maybe at the live show.
He was a pretty decently sized
guy. I want to check that out. I almost feel like we should have gotten a fanfare for your request of a fanfare.
Because
that was in and of itself. That's the first time you've ever done that.
Yep, well, big 4-0.
There you go.
We got to find a way for me to access the soundboard over here.
No.
You're not in on Thursdays.
No.
And so sometimes
on Thursdays you
people request a shofar.
Yeah, we'll turn it like this and then get a long stick.
Yeah, right.
We'll figure out something.
that's
folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook. Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.